Welcome to the Software Quality Today podcast presented by TX3 Services. This is a podcast for life sciences industry professionals about the trends and challenges of software testing and software quality in a regulated environment. And we'll be bringing you interviews from special guests and thought leaders each episode where we'll discuss all the latest topics around processes, solutions, and regulations. Today's guest, Don Jackson, is here as an individual subject matter expert and contributor. The views and opinions he shares are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of his employer, Micro Focus. Before we get started, please don't forget to rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and feel free to share with a colleague or two. And now, here's your host, Dora Gonzalez Azevedo.
Welcome to another episode of Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services. I'm your host, Dory Gonzalez Acevedo. Today, I'll be interviewing my friend and colleague, Don Jackson. Don is currently the Chief Technologist of Application Delivery Management at Micro Focus, an IT professional recognized as a thought leader with over 20 years of experience delivering testing and quality initiatives. Don has spoken at multiple conferences, webinars, seminars, as well as published articles and blogs. Don and I share a passion for helping customers modernize their software testing business processes with not only the latest and greatest testing tools, but also challenging the how to do better software quality testing. Today, now more than ever, using critical thinking is essential to making best use of our limited resources. Enjoy Don's thoughts about test automation, new innovations in AI capability, and some of his software testing predictions for the future. Enjoy our lively conversation. Welcome today to Software Quality Today. I am interviewing Don Jackson from Micro Focus today. I'm really excited, Don, for you to join us because I don't know if you recall, but like the first time we met was a long time ago in like 2012, 2013.
Yeah, I think I was a customer of Micro Focus back then. So We were using, as I recall, I think we were talking about eProof back then.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time. You know, I show my gray hair. I earn my gray
Me
hair.
Me too.
He was like, when did you get start? Oh, back in the 90s.
I know. It really has.
Last millennium.
My gray increases every day with some of our customers. That's for sure. Yeah. But now you are chief technologist of the ADM stack over at Micro Focus. Is that right?
Yeah. I moved into this role back in March. Prior to that, I was a field solution architect for ADM in the East. And then prior to that here, I was in the professional services organization as essentially pre-sales for professional services. So yeah, been here almost 7 years now.
Nice. And how did you get started in all of this? Because yes, you were a former customer. So tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Well, I mean, when you talk about backstory, so I'm a high context person. So forgive me if I go too deep, just say something. But, you know, I got involved in IT. Back in the day, I was I'd say IT is probably my my third career. I was in banking. And they asked us to, they asked me, I worked at the funding group for a wholesale mortgage lender. And they asked me to do the user acceptance testing for our new GUI system that was replacing our character-based system. So we had terminal emulators, you know, it was a mainframe system, and they were going to replace it with an Oracle Forms application. For those of you who have been around, I think it was Forms 4.5 or 4.0 back then. I got involved with it, and you know, I would sit, you know, I'd write up defects, and go sit with the developers, and they say, you can't do this in the system. I'm like, well, this is how I do it in the old system, and I can't do it in this way. And let's look at your code. And, you know, I started going, you know, I had one with one of the developers, Raj back then, one of the Rajas, because we had multiple Rajas on that program. But I said, let's look at your code. And I go, oh, well, the problem is your nesting's wrong, right? So this part of the nest needs to be one layer out. And he's like, how could you possibly understand that, right? Thinking of me as just a banker. And I'm like, well, you know, I did computer science stuff, you know, prior to my careers, right? I did computer science stuff in school. So we finished up that program, and they said, "Hey, we want to start a testing organization that you know we can find these problems that you're finding during UAT earlier in the cycle." And so I said, "Sure, that sounds great. You know, I can move into IT. Why not?" Right? Mm-hmm. They said, "Oh, we want to send you off for training for these tools." I'm like, "Okay, there are tools to do this, right?" Because we were just using Excel. And they're, "Yeah, we're going to send you to training for this thing called Test Director and this other tool called WinRunner." I'm like, "Okay, well, what do they do?" "Well, one of them manages your tests and the other one lets you automate your tests." And I said, "You can do that?" And so, you know, I went off to training and had a knack for it. I came back, and before I left that company, you know, we had we were doing the it's funny to see in the industry talking about, you know, traceability and how a lot of companies, it's still a new concept of traceability. Mm-hmm. And we had select business process modeling where we built out our models. We fed that and had that integrated into Caliber RM, requirements management, because back then Test Director didn't have requirements. Right?
Interesting. Yeah.
And then I integrated Caliber RM to Test Director. And then we had Test Director integrated with PBCS Tracker, and then Tracker integrated with Version Manager, where we had all of our code. So we had full traceability all the way from the process model,
wow,
all the way down to the code back in the 90s.
That's interesting. And you still needed multiple tools in order to get there.
Yeah. Back then it was, you know, a plethora of tools that you from different vendors. You know, a lot of those products are now actually Micro Focus products.
Right.
I'm not sure what happened to Select, honestly. I haven't looked into the business process modeling tools in a while, but I don't know if Select is still out there, but it was a great tool when I used it back then. So, you know, that's kind of how I got into IT. And then, you know, I had I did some consulting for about a year. I moved to another bank. And then we decided to move to relocate from the Ann Arbor area to the Columbus area. Go Blue, big Michigan fan living in Columbus. That was fun. And I went down there, as a consultant, as a testing consultant. And, I got, my first assignment, my only assignment as a consultant, was at a large healthcare distribution company outside of Columbus. So that's how I got into life sciences, and did. I was actually brought in there to do manual testing on a version of an application that, you know, this was early, 2001, I think, or 2000 actually was when I got hired on there. And they brought me in to do manual testing. I'm like, "Well, manual testing's great, but do you not have tools?" And they're like, "Well, we had this WinRunner tool, but we never really use it." And I said, "Right. Oh, can I have a license?" Right? And automated a bunch of stuff, and, you know, just my career kind of blossomed from there. Got into it was funny. Our networking team owned LoadRunner, and so we, as the manual testers, we'd write up, you know, these are the steps that we want to have done. And we'd send it off to the networking team, and they'd send us back, "This is how long it took." And that was the level of analysis you got from LoadRunner. And I went to my boss and I said, "You know, I don't know really anything about LoadRunner. I have a little anecdote about my first experience with LoadRunner back at the bank, but we can go into that if you want to at some point."
Okay.
I said, I don't really know much about LoadRunner other than conceptually, but I'm sure I can give you more than it took, you know, 45 seconds, right? I'm sure there's more that we can get out of it. So then I started the performance engineering team there, and that team has grown now to, I think the last I talked with somebody there, I think they had like 20 or 25 performance engineers. They have an automation team. You know, it's grown a lot. I was part of that growth, and then I had to move back outside of Ann Arbor again to take care of my mom in the last years of her life. And I teleworked for starting in 2004, and that company that I worked for, they had a decision to do everything in person, right? Co-locate everybody. Mm. And they said I had to move back. And, my kids were, had all developed roots here. And so I ended up switching jobs, and I figured, what better place to go than the dark side of the vendor. And so, that's kind of how I got into what was then HP and then HPE and then now Micro Focus. Kind of the not the long story, but not the short version of how I got started in this and honestly how I got into life sciences too. I love working with life science, because for me it's one of the things that I look for is the personal fulfillment that you get from your job, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I want the company that I work for to be providing or contributing to society as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. It gives me a sense of accomplishment. And mm-hmm. frankly, in life sciences, you talk about healthcare, how much closer to contributing to society can you get than, the health of somebody? So it was cool.
I really resonate with that. A lot of the customers that we work with, it's some of the stuff that they're doing and what they're making is really quite wonderful, right? Out in the world. And if we can make a small help in that process for them, that goes a long way for me as well. So I really resonate with that. But so it also sounds you've seen the evolution of these tools over the last decade or so too, right?
Yeah.
So with that, how do you see the evolution of the tools with the evolution of the companies that we help? Has technology gone too fast? Has the companies not, caught up?
Frankly, in the industry, right, you run into customers who are ahead of the curve. You run into a lot more that are on the curve or behind the curve, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's real challenging specifically in life sciences to be ahead of the curve when it comes to technology, especially when it comes to process change. Agile adoption, as you're well aware, right, is relatively low in life sciences because you have the challenge of the regulations and making sure that you can adopt an agile mindset or a DevOps mindset and those processes and do the organizational change management that goes behind that, but yet still be able to satisfy audit requirements. I think that's been a real challenge, and I think part of it goes towards what we see in the industry too is a lack of understanding of what's meant by you favor one over the other, right? So I favor work over documentation. That doesn't mean you don't do documentation.
Right.
That just means if you have to choose between doing something and enhancing the documentation, you want to do something. But that doesn't mean that I think there's a misnomer that's been adopted that means I don't have to document, right? If I do agile, I don't have to have requirements. Yeah. Some people feel that and that's just not the case, right?
Yeah.
And I think that leads towards the challenges of life sciences customers being able to make that change, adopt that OCM, the organizational change management, costs of transitioning to Agile and DevOps. But, the last couple of years, I think we're starting to see progress with that,
Yeah.
Especially with things like SAP, right? SAP historically, when you go back, it was very, very rigid waterfall. And, you look at things like GCTS, Git-enabled chain transport system that SAP is releasing out in the marketplace now. So this is how you do DevOps in an SAP context. So
yeah.
I think that's good for the industry that we'll be able to move forward with that.
Yeah. It's really encouraging. And at the same time, I know I work on the quality side a lot with the quality folks from our organizations and trying to translate that into what that looks like in a tool, right? Or trying to translate that you might not need that physical paper document, right? That it is documented. It's just in a tool, right? Yeah. Like, and that is really hard conceptually for folks to be able to wrap their heads around. But it's also really encouraging, like the SAPs and others of the world that are really doing some cutting edge technology stuff. And there's nothing that the FDA doesn't say that we want you to leverage all that innovation and technology, right? And so it's trying to take what the vendors are doing, which are state of the art sort of stuff, right? And matching that and marrying that with the culture within any given life science company, right? Because they're all different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was such a boon when I was a customer to be able to digitize that. The manual approval process. I mean, you think about an approval process, and maybe your process is that you need the person who executed the test, and we'll just talk about test execution. Mm-hmm. The person who executed the test, you need to have a separate quality or validation person. You know, it could be a computer systems validation person or whomever has to approve it, right? That they followed the process, but you also have to have a business person sign off on that as well. Okay. Well, they're not co-located. So right. I, as the tester, we'll assume it's a manual test, right? I run the manual test. I get all my validations. I sign it off. And now I put in an interoffice mail to ship over to right. three states over yep. to have the CSV person review my work. Lord forbid there's a problem and right. they have to send it back to me. We won't even talk about, you know, if there's a right. deviation, but they approve it and then they have to send it, you know, seven states over the other way in interoffice mail yeah. for the business person to review it and sign yeah. off on it. Then they got to send it back to the document management group to archive that and put it into, you know, a fire suppression location that's offsite.
Yep.
And that's just one test.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
You know? So literally, Don, when I validated your former employer's stuff, so I had my whole team in Pittsburgh manually executing all that stuff, right? And then I had to scan it all and I had to physically write it all. Like it yeah. was, and it was like three reams of boxes that had to be shipped back to that company.
Oh, yeah. It. Yeah.
And that was in 2013.
Right. And that was just validating the one system, the test yeah. system, right? So that we could stop doing this crazy process. And you think about that from an auditor's, from an auditing right. perspective. Auditor walks in and says, okay, show me this. Okay, well, now I have to have a catalog system and I have to go back and I have to go through my catalog to find out what box it's in at what yeah. warehouse. And where in that box, you know, in what aisle and what shelf mm-hmm. And then, you know, send out that request and get it back. You know, that might take a day, 2 days, right. you know, of transit time and finding the box in the warehouse. And then you hand it to the auditor to show it to him. And Lord, once again, oh no, what if there's some kind of deficiency right. in it? And now you got to start the whole process. Oh, it's just yeah. such a nightmare versus what you have when you do it electronically. You know, right. the auditor walks in and you go and they say, okay, show me this requirement and the providence that right. requirement has been fully tested. And you open up the system and you say, okay, I can show this to you electronically, or I could just print it out with all the electronic signatures attached yeah. to it. Print it out. Great. Print. Yeah. I hand Done. It off to the sheet of paper and I hand it to them. Right.
Yeah.
What a huge difference that makes.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love about the ALM Vera solution, right? Is because for the customers that utilize the tool in its entirety, right? Mm-hmm. You have that whole roadmap right in one tool. And there's then no question about like where it came from. Well, of course, because you did it in this release and then you did it here, yeah. right? Like it's just all there. So that's part of the elegance that I like. I do know, though, you're working on recently released the new Micro Focus Connect and a lot of new features there. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I talk about, you know, my transition where, you know, I came from HP and then HPE and then Micro Focus. But Micro Focus had their own solutions as well, right? So when we did that that spin merge of the HPE software and Micro Focus, and we merged into Micro Focus, you know, the Micro Focus solution stack brought a lot to the table as well. One of the products that they had in there is a product called Micro Focus Connect. We have Connect Core, which is a product that we don't sell. We give it away for customers who are entitled, you know, they have maintenance for one of our lifecycle tools. So a lifecycle tool could be ALM Octane, it could be ALM Quality Center, could be Silk Central, or any one of the other lifecycle tools. You know, PPM is another one. Or Lord forbid we forget to talk about PPM. because believe it or not, financials matter. Sorry. That was my little plug for PPM. But so Micro Focus Connect, it's the concept of having this integration. I don't want to say hub, but it's almost like a hub and a spoke a hub and spoke model, right? You have Connect, where you have a standard framework for how to send information from one endpoint to another. We provide that for free, and the only licensing restriction that you really have on that is that one of those two endpoints, when you build a connection, has to be a Micro Focus tool. Okay, so we have a bunch of third-party tools as well as the Micro Focus tools that have connectors out there. And you mentioned one of the recent innovations is we released a Solution Manager connector not too long ago. It came out. The official GA was in, I think it was early September. Took a little while to get it onto the website, you know, to where you could see it. But you could get it, the GA version of it, I think it was the beginning of September. And that's actually to replace some capability that that SAP decided to deprecate. Those of you that have been around for a while, they had a product, the Solution Manager. What do they call it? The Test Partner Adapter, I believe, is what they called it. And it essentially connected SAP Solution Manager with ALM Quality Center with the intention of there's really three core functionality functions or features, right? To use an agile term, right? The three key features, you know, because we're all going product-based now. Three key features that were in there. One is the business process hierarchy. So being able to bring in what's in the solution documentation of Solution Manager in the ALM Quality Centers, and that forms the basis for your requirements. Because you remember back in the day, Solution Manager only had a three-tier hierarchy. And so you would do the you know, mega process, the process, and the process step. You document that in Solution Manager, and then you could bring those in as the foundation for your requirements in ALM Quality Center. The second part is defects. So you write up you find a defect during testing, and you want to be able to associate that back to the solution documentation. So that would come in as an incident in Solution Manager, so that you could then, in an SAP context, you can then escalate that directly in the system to SAP. If it needed to go there, could be that basis, your basis team resolves it, or it could be something that basis had to escalate. But you would be able to have all that rich information about what was going on with it documented as part of the defect. Then the third part was integrating with Business Process Change Analyzer, BPCA. Well, SAP announced, I believe it was January 2019, that they were going to discontinue that. That product. So kind of the Solution Manager connector that we just released is to kind of plug that gap with the first release that came out, you know, covering BPH and the defects. BPCA is on the roadmap. Look forward to hearing that, hearing about that in the future. But cool. Yeah, so now, through Connect, which once again, it's delivered at no additional cost to the customer, you can now bring in those business process hierarchy or Jira user stories and epics, or maybe ServiceNow problems that got escalated to be defects. So they've got to come into the software, mm-hmm. and you can bring those into ALM. And then when you throw Vera on top of that, you have the rich signature capabilities and approval capabilities of Vera on top of those assets that you brought in from all these disparate tools right there in ALM Quality Center. So that you can then have, you know, that the story of being able to handle all those FDA requirements now becomes very easy, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, the locking down capabilities and all that wonderful, rich approval process that Vera lays on top of ALM QC.
Right, right. So you've had a lot of experience with SAP teams. And given all the S/4HANA implementations that are out there and going on, do you have any kind of key advice for those teams as they're moving forward and trying? I have teams that literally are still doing paper deployments of S/4HANA. Mm-hmm. And then I have the more robust customers that want to do automation first, right? Like, and everything in between. And so do you have any advice for folks out there that are on their journey of S/4HANA?
Well, I think one of the big things from an S/4HANA modernization, right? So we call it SAP modernization, right? Mm-hmm. At Micro Focus. But the big thing from my perspective is you should be taking that opportunity, just like SAP recommends, to really look at your business and transform your business. Mm-hmm. The downside of doing that, frankly, is that these rich automation assets you may have are no longer going to be valid because the business process itself has changed. However, the startlingly good news that you have in there is if you do use the Micro Focus solutions, is that we have released some really key enhancements specifically in the testing automation space over the past few years to really help you build much more resilient assets and to help you in your specifically in SAP. So, for example, in 2015, speaking of a long time ago, we released version 12.5 of UFT and BPT. UFT being Unified Functional Testing and BPT being Business Process Testing. So within the BPT framework, we have something called the Package Applications Kit, which is specifically for SAP GUI. So a lot of people think when you transform into an S/4HANA environment, you are going 100% Fiori, everything's web, and that's just not really realistic, and that's not the case, right? I've heard some people that I would consider experts, but you know, I'll leave it to other people to do their own research. But I've heard some people that I would consider experts in the SAP field saying anywhere from 50 to 70% of the business processes when you're done with your S/4HANA migration are still SAP GUI. Okay, so SAP GUI isn't going away.
Going away, yeah.
Right. So we released the Package Applications Kit back in 2015 that really accelerates what you do for test automation on SAP GUI. It does things like so the concepts that we introduced with BPT back when it was released in 2003 or 2005 or whenever it was, you know, way back in the day. Mm-hmm. When we released that concept, it was component-based testing, right? And one of the big challenges you have when you're adopting a component-based testing for a large enterprise is determining what that demarcation line is between components. Where does one component stop and the next one start? And how do you, once you define that, how do you ensure that everybody's following those rules so that you can reuse it? Because the whole benefit of doing component-based testing, just like component-based development, is about reuse. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't understand what's out in your library, you can't reuse it properly and frequently because just like developers, the best developers are lazy developers, right? Because they're going to develop their way out of something so they don't have to do it again. It's the same thing for test automation, right? The best test automation people that I've ever worked with are lazy ones because they're going to automate it and be done with it and never have to do it again. Mm-hmm. Well, because that's really good for getting that automation person to build a bunch of automation assets. The downside of that, because there's always a plus and minus, but the downside of having that good automation person is if I'm not going to spend a bunch of time interrogating my library to find out what's in the library that I can reuse. I'm just going to go build it myself. And we see this all the time, whether you're using a product to do component-based testing or you're just using, that has a built-in framework like BPT, or you built your own custom framework. Finding what's in the library takes time, and frequently people don't do that. So what ends up happening is that everybody uses the use case of login, right? I built a login. Dory, you built your own version of login, and the two shall never meet, right? And so your login, you build a login for all the scripts that you use, and you reuse login for all yours, and then I build a login for all the scripts that I do, and then and you take that out, the 10, 20 automation people, and now you've got 20 versions of login out there.
Right.
What we built inside of BPT for the SAP GUI is that it will automatically scan your component library and tell you if that component that you are, you're recording this new business process, if that component already exists. And we automatically set up what that demarcation line is in between components for SAP GUI. So you don't have to figure out, is a component a form? Is it a pop-up window? Is it a T code? What is a component? You don't have to figure that all out. And then the other thing, so we call that smart componentization, right? We build the components for you. It pops up and tells you, hey, this business process, these components you've already got in your component library, do you want to reuse them? And one would hope the answer would be yes. Of course I want to reuse them. It's the whole purpose of doing a component-based framework, right? But, sometimes you say no. But it also tells you what other tests are using that component as well. So let's say, it's only a 75% match to what you already did. Maybe I say, I want to reuse that component and go edit that component. Well, I need to understand the upstream impact of editing that component. So the framework tells you that as well. And then the real beauty of it, too, is we all know in test automation, one of the big challenges you have is about maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. You spend a ton of time on maintenance. A lot of people say as much as half of your time you spend maintaining existing scripts. Okay. Well, with the package application kit for SAP GUI, you can run your test in what's called change detection mode, which is something unique for SAP GUI with the package application kit. And what it does is it scans the forms that you're hitting to see if there are changes. So if you have a transport that goes in, and I show this with VA03, which is a very easy T code for people to understand, and that's the reason we picked it. So VA03 is view a sales order, right? VA is sales, 03 is view, right? The form, we add a required that you have to specify the sold to party in the transport, right? Well, normally your script would fail on the next component when it can't actually verify the details of the order itself, not on the submission screen, but on the order details itself. With the package application kit, it says, yes, it failed on that third component, but there was actually a change in the second component. And oh, by the way, here's what changed. Is it a defect or do you want to edit the script?
Gotcha.
Do you want to edit the component? So if you say it's a defect because you look at your charm request and, this wasn't a change that was in my charm request that should have been there, you just write up a defect and it opens up the defect in ALMQC and off you go. If it's a plan change, it's an expected deviation to the business process, you're wizard driven to handling that without ever having to touch any of the component details itself. You don't have to touch the object repository. You don't have to touch it from a keyword perspective if you're doing keyword driven. If you're doing script driven, you don't have to touch a script. It takes care of it all for you, right? You can pop up side by side of the two screens. You know, this is what it was when you created the script, the component. This is what it was during run. So you can make sure that it really looks like it. And you push the buttons and you say save, and it updates it, and it updates it for all of those other scripts that are using that component as well. Huge time save. But I know I'm anticipating your question, Dory. That's great for GUI, but what about the other 20 to 40% that's exactly. Fury? Yeah. So we released in technical preview I think it was like 3 years ago in UFT, our AI capabilities. Okay. And what is AI? Artificial intelligence, you know, it sounds like a buzzword. You know, some of the solutions out there, frankly, it's nothing more than a buzzword. Our AI is real. So what it does is the AI that we've infused in the UFT one, we've infused it in the UFT developer. We have a product that's in technical preview that comes with UFT one called Codeless, which is truly codeless. It's not just code suppressed. It's actually codeless. It has computer vision infused into it. Now, what's computer vision? Great question, Dory. Thanks for playing the game. computer vision is in the context of testing, because it can do many things. But computer vision in the context of testing is, I'm going to scan the screen the same way a human eye does. So if I came to you, Dory, and I said, hey, I got this new shopping website. Dory, can you find the shopping cart icon? Chances are you're going to be able to find the shopping cart icon.
Right.
Well, why is that? Right?
Because I can see it.
Well, why can you see it? Right? You've developed, you know, you have these synapses that you've developed, and you know what a shopping cart icon looks like. But if you start thinking about, well, what is it that makes me understand what is a shopping cart icon? Well, most shopping cart icons, they kind of look like a half of a hexagon, right? And it's might have a little line underneath the hexagon that represents the shelf underneath the basket, right, of a shopping cart. And it might have two dots or four dots underneath it to represent the wheels, maybe a squiggly line to the side to represent the handle. And because of all those visual characteristics and the human brain's amazing, right, with the synapses, all those synapses fire and you go, oh, there's my shopping cart icon, right? Now, you don't have to, it doesn't take you that long to figure it out, obviously, right? Your brain works much faster than that. So it's the same concept as is done in computer vision, is it's looking for those visual characteristics, those visual cues of what is that object? What does it look like? And then making a determination with a confidence level. And if that confidence level is over a certain threshold, it says, haha, it's a shopping cart icon, or haha, this is a search icon, which is a magnifying glass. Kind of looks like a capital Q, actually, if you ever think about it. If you throw an OCR engine to look at a magnifying glass, you might get back Q. That's kind of funny. so, you know, that's part of what we infuse in there. What does that mean from a test automation standpoint, though? So I've been doing test automation, like I said, since the 90s. We've always had to deal with object properties. And the challenge with object properties is that if you change the underlying technology, depending on what development framework you're using for the application, it might be build by build, those object properties change. You think about some of the open source solutions out there. Selenium, great solution. I don't knock Selenium. In fact, Micro Focus is a contributing sponsor to the Selenium project. Selenium's a great tool. However, there's some limitations because it's using object properties, like the XPath. XPath is notorious for changing. Okay, so I get a new build and all of my XPaths have changed. Well, that means I got to go in and change how they're the properties for each of those objects. And so I now have that time sink of maintenance where I'm spending all this time in maintenance now. With the AI capabilities that we've introduced, you don't utilize those object properties at all. imagine building, for those of you, you know, that are listening to this, and you've done test automation, imagine building a UFT script and there is no object repository. It just works. What happens if I change it from light mode to dark mode? It still just works because it doesn't care. It doesn't, just like you and I don't care if it's in light mode or dark mode, although my old eyes prefer dark mode. Just like we don't care if it's in light mode or dark mode to see, you know, the visual characteristics of that shopping cart icon, that the computer vision doesn't care either. Mm-hmm. So you start being able to recognize tremendous benefits. And then you multiply that out by how many different platforms you're delivering this application. Talk about an SAP context, right? Fiori, the whole concept for Fiori is that you build it, it works on your desktop or your mobile device.
Right.
Doesn't matter. Works the same way.
Right.
Right? That's the benefit of Fiori. For test automation, wait. No. Because iOS exposes these properties. Mm-hmm. The Android SDK exposes these properties. Chrome exposes these properties. And if Lord forbid, you're still using IE, there's a whole nother set of properties, right? So mm-hmm. now I got four different versions of the script for the same business process. Mm-hmm. And then I have a transport that goes in that makes a change. Now I have four different scripts I have to update for the same business process.
Right.
And Lord forbid you weren't doing component-based testing. And you know, you can see how this maintenance time sink just keeps getting multiplied out.
So in this new computer AI mode, though, do you still need a developer? Like because in the old way, you really needed true developers to script test automation. Is there a different entry point here in terms of who can do these types of scripting now?
There is. It's absolutely, you now can have people that are really, we used to call them business analysts or domain experts or whatever. They can now contribute to test automation. Instead of them, you know, writing a manual test in Excel and you importing that later into ALM, using the Excel add-in, and then you apply the Vera e-signature on top of that and then they change it, and then you're stuck back all over again. How am I going to re-import the, you know, all mm-hmm. that nightmare? They can go in there and build scripts because you look at it and at the window when you bring up the spy, it highlights all these things and says, these are all the things I see on there. If they're using Codeless, which, like I said, it's in technical preview, it will be an actual GA separate product once we feel it's feature rich enough to stand on its own. But you can use Codeless right now in its technical preview mode, and that has, on top of the computer vision and OCR, it's got natural language processing in it as well. Yeah. So they can write. A manual tester could write a script, and if this syntax scares them, then you have a bigger problem than what we're trying to solve. You can write something that says "click the profile," mm-hmm. and it will go out. Click is right. a word that comes out there, and then says, mm-hmm. and profile is a reserved name, and we know what a profile button icon is. You know, kind of looks like a person, right? Mm-hmm. Little circle, shoulders, right. Might have a tie, might not.
Right.
I prefer a bow tie, but so they can write these near plain English scripts.
Right.
And I use the word script loosely, right? Because it's not code.
Right.
And if you think about where this is going, right, as the AI inside of IT, as AI continues to develop and we continue to release these capabilities in there, you may get to the point at some point where the natural language processing can understand nuance, which is something that it's still out there, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
Think about you know how you and I converse, right? If I ask you to test the Google search bar, the Google search capabilities. I'd say, okay, Dory, I want you to do a Google search on dog and make sure dogs come back, right? That's how we would converse, right?
Right.
you understand the nuance of the English language that, you know, okay, I know he said a Google search, so that means he wanted me to bring up my default browser, go to google.com and type in the value that he wants me to type in, which he told me was dog, right? So I'm going to type dog into the search box and I'm going to hit the search button. Not that I'm feeling lucky, but the Google search button, right? And then and he said, verify that dogs come back. So right. I need to click on the images results and look for pictures of dogs, right? Those are all the steps that, you know, you can intuit out mm-hmm. of the instruction I gave you based on the nuance, right?
Yeah.
That's where I think, this is Don speaking, I think we're going to get to with natural language processing in the coming years. Mm-hmm. Is it next year? I don't think so. But it's coming, right? To where you can get to that point where it understands nuance. Then you can throw translation on top of that, right? Mm-hmm. Nuance and translation. And, you know, you can start to, you know, expanding this, you know, globally to not just the English speakers, but to the entire world.
Yeah, I have a customer that's doing some really cool stuff with deploying software in multiple languages. And they have to do it right now manually, right? Like mm-hmm. they have to, you know, hire different people, different language sets to be able to translate all of that manually. And long-term, that's not a solution, right? And they're looking at other alternatives. But at the same time, like it has to start with that, that basic level. Yeah.
And we have actually baked into UFT1 today, that the OCR you can load in different languages. So when you're reading off the screen, like if you're keying off of text on the screen in order to interact with it, mm-hmm. by the way, you're not using an object repository. Mm-hmm. No object repository. you can data drive off of that and say, okay, well, if I'm running my English test, I want to look for the welcome. Mm-hmm. If I'm running my French test, was it bienvenue or bonjour or mm-hmm. whatever my 3 years of French from seventh, eighth, and ninth grade are showing that it's been a while, right? But whatever that language is, right, you can data drive that and then go, okay, you know, load in my, you know, if I'm running my French test, load in the French OCR instead of the English OCR and work on that and you know, whatever, all of the different languages that are in there.
Yeah, that's very cool. Cool stuff. So that's some of the new things that are coming out from Micro Focus. I know you guys have made also lots of other updates in your ADM stack as well, more recently too, right? Like, so Octane has some new advancements.
Yeah, I mean, Octane, you know, you think about Octane in a DevOps context, and, you know, we have a point of view that I put out there around the shift culture, right? You know, some people say shift left, some people say shift right. The World Quality Report said, I think it was 56% of the respondents said, I need to shift left more, and 53% said, I need to shift right more. And our point of view is they're both right.
Yeah.
You need to shift left more. You also need to shift right more. And you need to not forget the incredibly valuable mindset of the QA, that central persona, right? All three personas have to be, mm-hmm. Have to be taken care of. But there's actually a fourth persona that needs to be involved that very frequently people don't talk about. And that's your management persona. And that's where Octane comes in. So you can layer Octane on top of all of your DevOps tool chain and be able to start making data-driven insights from across your entire DevOps tool chain, and so that you can make actionable, accurate decisions based on the data instead of people's feelings, right? Because you're never going to have a director or a VP scraping through Jenkins logs. That's just not going to happen.
Right.
With Octane, you know, which you can layer on top of, you know, yes, we would love it if people wanted to, you know, do a complete rip and replace everything in their tool chain with Micro Focus solutions like Pulse Uno for source code management and, you know, plugging the Git. By the way, did you know in Git, a developer can rewrite history.
No,
with
I did
no
not
changes.
Know that.
It's not under change control by Git.
Oh, natively. I did not know that.
Oh my gosh! In a life sciences, can you imagine if an auditor came in and went, "Hey, prove to me that you have immutable history." Oh, you can't. The comments. It's just the comments. So you can layer Pulse Uno on top of that, and you know we'll close that gap. We'll provide workflow as well, and but to the developers, it'll still feel like they're still using Git because it still is Git underneath it. It's just we're closing those gaps. We would love it if you wanted to rip and replace all of your solutions with all Microfocus. But the real scenario is let us help you close those gaps where you have it. So maybe you're only using Git, right? Like we talked about that gap that you have there. We can layer Pulse Uno on top to take care of that. Or maybe you tell us, hey, you know, we don't have a really good static code analysis tool, right? And Don, I've heard you say all the time, you never call it DevSecOps. Why don't you call it DevSecOps? Well, because security, of course, is part of DevOps. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's embedded. You do security testing, right? You do static code analysis. Okay, well, we can layer Fortify on top there. Or maybe you say, hey, I've got, you know, some great Selenium stuff, but, you know, I've got some fat client applications that I need to do automation as well. And I'm having some challenges with some of my, some of the XPath stuff that we talked about. Great. We can talk about UFT developer or UFT one, whatever the case is, let's plug your gaps so that you can have a good picture. But then ALM Octane can sit on top of all of that to give you real intelligence about what's going on. Octane gives you things like, hey, we've seen this type of commit in the past. You've got a build failure and you've got, you know, 35 people who submitted into that build. We've seen that and we know how the behavior of those developers. We're going to suggest that, you know, you might want to assign this build failure to Don because he's a pretty bad developer. Now, it doesn't say that, but you know, you get the concept, right? Of you know, we've seen the commit patterns, we've seen what's going on, we've learned from what's going on in your organization, and we can assign build failures out quicker. I mean, that's hugely valuable. You know, mean time to resolution. You talk about it in the context of ITOM. Usually, I don't know why we don't track more inside of ADM, the mean time to resolution on defects, right? Mm-hmm. Why don't we track that more as an organization? I think it's hugely valuable. And if we can move that needle by suggesting who needs to be on that defect, that build failure first, I think that's hugely valuable. It's just the challenge is we haven't, as an industry, we haven't quantified that real well. Historically.
Yeah,
I think we should.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the quantification, because I've asked a lot and I'm brought in for assessments and this and that, right? But when I go in, so where is your data today, right? Like, so everyone wants ROI and metrics and this and that, but they haven't done any collection of any of that for the last 20, 25 years. So, you can establish a baseline, but it's also, what is even reasonable in terms of the growth over time? I don't know. I mean, I can take a guess, an educated guess, you know, based on some trends and things I see at corresponding, you know, similar size customers, you know, all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, one of the things you said that really resonated with it is this business level view, right? You know, a lot of the higher up you get, right? The more you want to know, well, what am I absolutely going to get? You know, what is this, you know, what's the reduction of time? What's the increase of success? What's the decrease of failure? Like all of these things and hard numbers. And it's like, guys, I'm not sure, you know, like.
Well, you haven't been tracking that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me go get my sticky note off the whiteboard. How long did it take for me to move this sticky note from this swim lane to that swim lane?
Yeah.
Well, you did it on a whiteboard. Guess what?
Nor do you know the actual quality of what you've been producing either. Right. And so, and this is where I really struggle sometimes of, you know, trying to get folks to focus in a risk-based way, right? Not to just throw out 1,000 requirements because you can write 1,000 requirements. lots of software does lots of things. It doesn't mean you as an end user are going to need to test every single thing, right? There also needs to be this level of trust on the vendor side that the vendor is producing a piece of software that they've gone through their process for. They follow a strict SDLC, whatever that framework is for them, and they feel confident to sell it on the market, and they're giving you access to use that, right? Like, and it doesn't mean that you have to repeat all of that, right? But what are you going to use it for? And really kind of honing in, but that also doesn't happen on the on the regular either.
I mean, focusing on what you customized versus and configured versus what is the out of the box functionality that everybody uses,
right?
I don't need to go into to SAP and make sure that I can log into SAP, right? I'm pretty sure they released the latest version where you can log in. Now, yes, I have to test it because I have to get through login, right? That's you'll hear me sometimes talk about implicit versus explicit testing.
Absolutely,
right? Implicitly, I'm testing login, but I'm not doing checkpoints, right? I'm not doing explicit testing of login because of course I can log in.
Right.
Now, I may want to performance test login. In fact, I would argue if you're not performance testing login, you might be missing the boat, right? And you talked about quantifying things. You know, one of my favorite requirements of all time from a non-functional requirement standpoint is when they say it's got to be fast. And you're like, okay.
Fast, your fast are two different things. Yeah. I mean, I still see a lot of that though.
Yeah.
I people send me their requirement specs and I see things that are, you know, haven't changed, and the way in which we talk about requirements and, you know, education of smart requirements. And that doesn't seem to necessarily resonate across the board equally. I also struggle with how to teach the new generation that, right? And, and how and where, you know, some of our customers are willing to spend the investment in training. Others are not. Others want you just to come in and fix their problems. And while that's a short-term fix, it doesn't, you know, help the organization over long-term, right? And that long-term help and support does cost money. Just as if, you know, I'm not going to spend a couple million dollars on test automation when I don't maybe have that capacity in-house to do that long-term. Yeah. Like, you know, like it's kind of like having those conversations of what is the real goal here, right? And I had read the World Report that Micro Focus recently published, and it's interesting to me, some of the things that I read in there, just given what I actually experience on a day-to-day basis with 40 plus customers that we span.
Well, you know, requirements engineering is a discipline. It's an engineering discipline. And I think that's one of the things that we as an IT industry have failed with the DevOps transformation and agile transformations that have happened in the last decade or so, is that we've really gotten away from good requirements engineering disciplines. One of the last things I did at the company that I worked for in Ohio was I was reviewing. So it was a huge transformational program that we were on, and we had over 40,000 requirements. And one of my jobs amongst, you know, all the technical part of that was, because of my background and having done BA work in the past, was to review requirements. And I would explain to some of the people that were on the team, you know, the first thing that I look for is an ambiguity check, right? I'm looking for ambiguous words, fast, good. You know, these are non-quantifiable terms, right?
Right.
What does fast really mean? Well, you know, if you go to Google, fast means something totally different than if you go to a little mom and pop shop down the street that they have, you know, a website that they built with the, you know, free website builder, right? They're totally different expectations of what you have to have. So, you know, doing that ambiguity check is something critical that, and frankly, with the way that we handle backlog management today in the IT industry, I'm not faulting any individual, I'm saying we as an industry, I think we need to do a better job of adhering to good requirements engineering principles. Mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to life sciences, right? I don't want to have, I had a surgery recently. I don't want to go in there and have them say, well, the medicine's good. One, good's not good enough for me. If you're mm-hmm. putting it in my body, I want great, fantastic, right? Tony the Tiger, great, right?
Yep.
But secondly, I want you to quantify what good means, right? Because mm-hmm. good enough isn't good enough for me, right? It's got to be, like I said, Tony the Tiger, great. Yeah. I don't know, I may get in trouble for people won't remember who Tony the Tiger is, right?
That is true.
That's more likely the problem, right? Next thing you know, I'm going to have a Starsky and Hutch reference that comes out, and, you know, you and I will be laughing along and the listeners will be going, Starsky and what?
There was
a red car. What? Did it use gasoline? Ew.
I know. It is. And I mean, some of the things that we're talking about, and I know there's other folks that we're connected to that we can probably go on and on and on about some of the things that are reoccurring themes that we see, regardless of the changes in technology, regardless of the changes of organizations and tools. Some of the fundamental things still haven't significantly shifted over the years. And that is a struggle. And that's one of the things that I hope to help our customers with. I know you do that as well on a day-to-day basis. And I always enjoy bringing you into calls because it helps keep my ideas fresh and moving forward. As well as I try to learn from all my technology friends, cause that's not my strong suit, but I hear your vision and I applaud that. And I try to get others on board with doing things better.
Yeah. There's some really wonderful things that are coming out of IT right now, and that specifically in ADM, in application delivery management, are really, frankly, game changers. I mean, they're truly paradigm shifters. The AI capability we talked about, mm-hmm. I think, is earth-shattering mm-hmm. difference.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. To me, it is as revolutionary to test automation as WinRunner was when it came out on on Windows 95, right? Mm-hmm. It was like the first time that I saw something that could do automation robustly,
right,
on Windows 95, right, in a Windows environment. I think it's as game changing as that. I would say for IT containerization is another one of those trends that is almost as, if not as, game changing for the industry as the AI capabilities are for test automation. You think about containers, and I published I'm not sure if it's come out yet. I guess I'll give you a little preview. I put out a prediction that I said I think 2022 is going to be the year of the container. I think we're finally at the point where we've got adequate security for containers, right? And when you think about the deployment and how long it takes to deploy software, if you can take that deployment and make it repeatable, robust, and 95% faster with containers, I mean, 95% might not be the right quantification of faster, but I've seen stuff like that. So like our demo environments for our Micro Focus tools, we've gone all container based on, mm-hmm. on our demo environments for the server side. Mm-hmm. I spin up ALM, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So if I come in and do an ALM demo, I spin it up in Docker and it takes on my laptop, like keep in mind on my laptop,
right? Yeah.
It takes between 45 and 50 seconds to spin up and have ALM ready to go from cold.
Right.
That's insanely awesome. Fast.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're talking about a database server, a file server, a web server. You've got a Apache starting up, and you've got all of that mm-hmm. in less than a minute. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming in, let's say I'm going to Dory International and I want to do a demo for Dory International and I want, you know, the Dory products in there, right? So mm-hmm. I'm making this customized demo environment just for Dory International. I can save that off and in 2 or 3 minutes, I'm ready to go for Don International mm-hmm. for the next one because of containers, because right. Of how quickly it is. And that's just my use cases for demoing right. stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you take that into, and you know, you think about what if I containerized, I did a containerized deployment of ALM. Okay. And we Micro Focus, we just released version 16 of ALM, right? And you're on version, let's say you're on version, 15.0, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to upgrade to 16. Today, you have the capability. You can deploy ALM 16 via container. It's in our documentation on the ADM help site, which is admhelp.microfocus.com. You could deploy that in your 15 environment. You could export all of your projects into QCP files, import them into 16, run the upgrade step in 16, and you're done. No more.
Wow.
No more.
You just saved my life for the next 2 to 3 years.
I mean, really?
No one's upgrading.
You know, think about, yes, the export, you know, if you have a multi-terabyte project file, it's going to take a while to do the up.
Sure, yeah.
Well, one, you shouldn't have multi-terabyte project files. We need to have a different consulting conversation about how you should be structuring your data. But... Mm-hmm. All of that work that we used to do, you know, you think about, you know, back in the pre like 12.5 days of okay, I've got to copy over the file repository, I've got to back up the database and restore the mm-hmm. database on the new database server, and oh, by the way, I can't switch between Oracle and SQL Server. That's a whole different problem. You can't do you just don't do that. And then I got to edit the DBID XML. And, you know, and by the way, for those of you who have never gone through one of these upgrades back in the day like that, it was painful, right? And it was a lot of work to do it. And now, oh, you want to switch from Oracle to SQL Server? Sure, not a problem. You see that button that says export to QCP file? Hit that. Okay, yeah, it's going to take a little bit, you know, while it exports all the data. Okay, now go to your new one and say, you got to make sure you use the SQL Server.
So let's just be clear, all our listeners out there, this is after 12.5.3, right? So version 12.6 and up, right?
Yeah, 12.6 and up, right.
Just to be clear.
But you know, man, you talk about an innovation. And right. to me, this is one of those innovations that, you know, we don't talk about at all. We don't really talk about, because it's really about, you know, it's just for upgrade. It's only right. for upgrades.
Right,
and
right.
then you have people that, you know, have been using the product for 20 years and they're like, oh my gosh, you just made my upgrade life so much easier.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Instead of a year to do my upgrade, I can now get it done in a week. Oh my gosh.
That's a big changer. Yeah.
But you know, containers give you that capability too of, you know, you think about what if software vendors started saying, I'm only going to deliver my software in a container.
Well, that's a very interesting concept.
And right. this is to be clear, this is Don's opinion. This is Don's prediction is that containers are really going to be.
Yeah. No, yeah.
And like
but,
any
but
prediction,
I like that. Yeah. But going through and let's pull that thread, because that I literally had another customer just this morning saying we want to use a different database. I'm like, well, that's nice for you, but that's not what we developed it on. Right. Like in this transportability, the concept of to containers to be able to do that opens up a whole nother, you know, opportunity if that's the case. And I think that vendors, if they say this is what it is what it is,
yeah.
right? Like, I mean, it does. I like it.
Think about it. Think about, you know, in that exact example you were just talking about. Think about. If as a software vendor, right, the product that you guys are delivering, you don't expose what database you're using, right? It's just the database container.
Yep.
right? So, you know, maybe it's a case that you're using Postgres, right? So, you know, you're handling all of the open source licenses and all that as a software manufacturer. It doesn't matter to the customer then what database you're using under the covers.
Right.
You just deliver a container that has, it's the database container, right?
Yeah.
And you just point the application container to the database container, right? Mm-hmm. That's the configuration that the customer has to do. Mm-hmm. Whoa, my gosh, right? All these questions about, you know, well, I got to get an Oracle license or a SQL Server license. Mm-hmm. And well, this particular application, we're a SQL Server shop, but this particular application only delivers on Oracle and we don't have any Oracle DBAs or anybody who really knows anything about that. Yep. So I'm kind of stuck if I run into an Oracle error, right?
Yeah.
That all that goes away if we in the software industry start delivering stuff in containers and take that out there. Now, I'm not saying in my prediction that 2022 is when we'll have this all figured out.
Right.
Everybody will be delivering.
But the trend is here. I think you're 100%. Yeah.
It'll behoove software companies to start delivering things via container. And you have things like Kubernetes, you know, from a deployment strategy, right? And scaling up and scaling down, dynamically scaling and I can hyperscale that out to the cloud, right? Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. By the way, you know, speaking of cloud bursting.
Yeah.
Oh, it's almost like it was like a plant that I put out there. You know that you can cloud burst for LoadRunner. Like, we give you LoadRunner developer for free. Oh, wait, did Don just say for free? Yes. We give you LoadRunner developer for free for 50 users, which is about all that most laptops can handle anyways. Mm-hmm. And then you could cloud burst using cloud burst credits out to LoadRunner cloud for that. Did you guys know that?
Mm-mm.
Wow. That's huge, right?
That is really cool.
So, yeah. Oh, I can write my LoadRunner developer script. I can configure it all from my IDE. I can configure in the credentials for cloud bursting that off. You know, you can have that central procurement team that buys the cloud burst credits and you can allocate them out. And it's a beautiful thing. I mean, there's huge changes that are coming in the industry.
Awesome. Well, Don, as always, a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks, Dory. I like talking with you too. I could do this all day because I have lots of opinions and crazy anecdotes from, you know, personal experience that.
Yeah. Oh, so we'll schedule some more time.
Yeah.
We'll do it another day. But I really thank you for sharing your thoughts and we will wrap this up.
All right. Thanks, Dory. Have a great
one. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today with Dory Gonzalez Acevedo. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, tx3services.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please feel free to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. Also, be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous episodes. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter at tx3services. This has been a TX3 Services production. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.